Section 2. Government Forms, War and Strategy. Chapter 3. Monarchy and War by Erich von Kuhnelt-Lodin. Modern history is nothing but an inventory of bankruptcy declarations. Nicolas Gomez de Villa. 1. Monarchy is a form of government rarely well understood in North America. To many people in that part of the world, it seems by now a totally obsolete, childish institution. The surviving monarchies, after all, might play a symbolic or even a psychological role, but not really a decisive political role. As a rationalist and as a liberal, in the worldwide and not in the American sense, I am also a monarchist who realizes that, combined with Christianity and antiquity, monarchy was responsible for the rise and flowering of Western civilization, which by now is slowly assuming an almost global character, penetrating the whole world. Yet, modern man's mind is political rather than historical, and is therefore hopelessly tied to the spirit of his time. In the words of Goethe, "He who cannot give account of the last 3,000 years rests in darkness unexperienced, though he lives from day to day." Such a person, intellectually nurtured by the boob tube and newspapers, would be greatly surprised to hear a British Prime Minister, Disraeli, saying, quote, "The tendency of an advanced civilization is, in truth, monarchy. Monarchy is indeed a government which requires a high degree of civilization for its full development. An educated nation recoils from the imperfect vicariate of what is called a representative government." End quote. Democracy is, after all, the oldest form of government, where majorities rule over minorities. It is still today preserved by Aborigines in various parts of the globe. You can find the names of the ethnologists who have studied this phenomenon in some of my books. Democracy reappeared in a more civilized form in Athens, but when Socrates, in a truly political trial, praised monarchy, he was condemned to death. Remember also that Madariaga said rightly that our civilization rests on the death of two persons, a philosopher and the Son of God, both victims of the popular will. No wonder that Plato, Socrates' follower, and Aristotle, Plato's disciple, were fierce monarchists, and that the latter, when democracy returned to Athens, went into exile in order to not suffer the fate of Socrates. In accordance with these leading philosophers of antiquity, Thomas Aquinas maintained that democracy was the least bad of the three evil forms of government. Ochlocracy and tyranny, he admitted, were even worse. Plato's thesis that democracy naturally evolves into tyranny was also adopted by Polybius, who believed in an anacyclosis, a natural circular evolutionary process from monarchy into aristocracy, aristocracy into democracy, and democracy into tyranny. Indeed, reading Plato's Republic, books 8 and 9, one gets an exact description of the transition from the Weimar Republic to National Socialist tyranny. The historically conscious observer realizes not only that countries like Great Britain, Spain, or the Netherlands, which today are monarchies, went through republican periods. Greece and Mexico, today republics, had already twice been monarchies. Still, the most educational case is that of Rome. If we had the opportunity, given also our knowledge of history, to meet a Roman citizen in the 60th year before Christ and told him that his country soon would become a monarchy, he certainly would have reacted most vigorously, blaming us for totally ignoring the Roman tradition and mentality. Monarchy, a return to the authoritarianism of Tarquinius Superbus, out of the question. Yet Caesar already loomed beyond the horizon. Now, if we had the chance to meet with one of his descendants in the year 260 after Christ and told him of his ancestors' indignation about our naivete and arrogance, he certainly would have shrugged his shoulders. Of course, he was right. But in the meantime? In the meantime, we are still a republic. Look at signs everywhere saying Senatus Populusque Romanus. A monarchy? As among Orientals and barbarians? Out of the question. But you have an emperor. Ha ha, imperator means general, and there always have been generals in republics. Yet a few years later, Diocletian, the Imperator Augustus, had a golden crown put on his head and demanded proskynesis, the kneeling approach to his person. Then even the most stupid Romans realized that the Republic had gone the way of all flesh. Tacitus, indeed, had suspected it a long time before. There are still outstanding thinkers who have a deep respect for the monarchical order, for rational as well as sentimental motives. Yet even the rationalist has to take the psychological factor into his calculations, or he would cease to be a realistic rationalist. As a matter of fact, the increasing democratization of Western civilization has fostered monarchophile thinking, although only on a rather high level. Thus, it is not surprising that Theodor Herzl, founder of Zionism, had declared monarchy to be the best form of government, but, since no descendants of David survived, the aristocratic constitution of Venice should be studied in the planning of a Jewish state, whereas democracy, as the worst type of rule, was to be strictly avoided. History is already telling us how right he was. This introduction is necessary to understand the relationship between monarchy and war, monarchy and warfare. Yet we are limiting ourselves here to the Christian monarchy in our civilization, and not discussing some abstract form of monarchy. Bear in mind that Arche is not Kratos. We have indeed to remember the words of Nicolas Gomez d'Avila that, without Christianity and antiquity as their background, Europeans would be nothing but pale-faced barbarians. Nor should we forget that war is a calamity to be avoided, one of many results of our imperfections due to original sin, even if soldiers by and large play a positive role in the New Testament. Many of our saints, from St. Francis to St. Ignatius, have fought in battles. Still, eliminating or at least limiting war should be one of the goals to be achieved historically, in our time or in the future. 2. The First Enlightenment produced the French Revolution, the great historical revival of democracy, a sadistic sex orgy in which, indeed, the divine Marquis played personally and intellectually a leading role. It is not here the place to portray the revolution's unspeakable horrors, which, to a broader public, were revealed only in the years preceding its 200th anniversary in 1989. But, in order to explain its effects on wars and the methods of warfare, it is necessary to highlight its character and role in history. It wanted to bring liberty and equality under a common denominator, something Goethe considered only charlatans would promise. Equality, indeed, could merely be established in some form of slavery, just as a hedge can only be kept even by constantly trimming it. In this perverse competition between liberty and equality, the latter naturally won out. Robespierre, before being dragged to Notre-Dame-la-Guillotine, had planned to put all Frenchmen into one uniform and all French women into another. He also wanted to eliminate all church steeples as undemocratic, since they were taller than other buildings. The revival of democracy from antiquity, with its ideal of equality, was closely connected with nationalism, a term understood by most Europeans as what in America might be called ethnicism, not to be confused with racism, which is not a linguistic cultural, but a biological concept. The basic drive we are alluding to is the craving for sameness, the twin of equality. Whatever is the same is also equal, but not the other way around. Differences, after 1789, became suspect and were to be rejected, eradicated. The traditional outlook of our culture, indeed, was vertical. God, Father in heaven, the Holy Father in Rome, the King as the Father of the Fatherland, and the Father as the King in the family. In the lands of the Reformation, the monarch, not the Pope, was head of the Church. Connected with the fathers figured the mothers, from the Regina Coeli down to the queens and the various matriarchs. The new order now was increasingly flattened out until it became horizontal. Of course, not the people as such could rule, but the majority over the minority, and numbers assumed immense importance. Even truth became a matter of majorities, and the bigger the majority, the truer the right answer. The ideal was the consent, the affirmation by the majority, finally achieving almost a totality. Hence also the totalitarian root of democracy, which stands for the politicization of the entire people. Even the children, although not voting, are now educated in that direction. It is obvious that the new order could tolerate no estates, and soon the demand rose to eliminate social differences based on wealth and income, rather than only on birth. For this development, one did not have to wait for Karl Marx. In 1794, the popular ire also turned against the rich, and some already were guillotined just for that reason. Needless to say, the new horizontalism also conflicted with the Christian tradition, which emphatically does not stand for equality. In the French schoolbooks, one can read, "The terror was terrible but grand," which, in view of our bottomless human stupidity, one nice day one might even say about German national and Russian international socialism. Most of our contemporaries assume that the victims of the guillotine were largely degenerate aristocrats, and that the final benefits of the revolution were greater than the damages or losses the French suffered. Yet, only a few years before the celebration of its 200th anniversary in 1989, a flood of well-documented books came out which tore the mask away from the face of that godless event. Already in 1986, the French deputy Bernard Antony warned the European Parliament in Strasbourg not to celebrate 1789, since it had bred national and international socialism. About that time came the revelations of François Furet, Simon Sharma, and above all, Raynal Secher, for whose terrifying volume Professor Jean Mayer wrote in his preface that the worst and most nauseating atrocities could not even be mentioned. We are told that in this sadistic sex orgy, pregnant women were squeezed out in fruit and wine presses, mothers and their children were slowly roasted to death in bakers' ovens, and women's genitals were filled with gunpowder and brought to explosion. We cannot continue to dwell on these unspeakable horrors, and should not be surprised that Sade was invoked, in whose pornographic writings long passages are devoted to philosophical and anti-religious reflections. The infamies and cruelties of the French Revolution were of such a low nature that the national and international socialists appear in comparison to these democrats as sheer humanitarians. In the number of victims, however, they could not beat them, since the world has technically progressed after 1789, and now offers greater possibilities for mass murder. The 1989 celebrations of the French Revolution concentrated unilaterally on the Declaration of Human Rights, in the shadow of the guillotine, and did not even mention the fall of the Bastille with its most unsavory details. The invention of the guillotine was, psychologically, a step in the new direction, the mechanization of swift murder. Yet the French Revolution left behind something much worse than the guillotine, because it was permanent, the radical change in the nature of wars which made this human calamity more extensive and intensive, conscription. 3. The social pyramid in this new horizontalism was now upturned, and quantity, not quality, had its day, for everybody had the same rights, a truly microscopic share in decisions, effective only if it contributed to a majority, and also the same obligations. One could vote for a representative, but in turn, a male had the duty to defend his country, or to participate in its aggressions, which might mean drudgery in barracks, captivity, wounds, mutilation, or even death. Indeed, a very bad deal. The draftee almost ceased to be a real person, and he was dragged out of his privacy and became an individual, a term which really means only the last indivisible part of a collective whole. Hippolyte Taine describes the results of this return to the stage of primitive tribes with these ringing words, taken from his Origine de la France Contemporaine. Quote, "One puts in the hands of each adult a ballot, but on the back of each soldier a knapsack. With what promises of massacre and bankruptcy for the 20th century, with what exasperation of ill will and distrust, with what loss of wholesome effort, by what a perversion of productive discoveries, accompanied by what an improvement in the means of destruction, by what recoil toward the inferior and unhealthy forms of the old combative societies, by what a backward step toward egoistic and brutal instincts, toward the sentiments, manners, and morality of ancient cities and barbaric tribes we know all too well." End quote. One of the most immediate and degrading consequences of the general military service in the time of war was the indoctrination of the draftee. They were, in their vast majority, innocent and largely even unwilling civilians, whose enthusiasm for fighting and killing was very limited. So, they were taught to hate the enemy, degraded to the impersonation of wickedness, ugliness, and devoid of all virtue. This had been different in previous ages, when soldiers were men, gentlemen as well as ruffians, who loved to fight and offered their services to anybody who led and paid them well. Prince Eugène of Savoy had vainly offered his services to France, but ended up as the glorious military hero of the Habsburgs. The same happened finally to Baron Gideon Lawdon, born in Livonia, but of Scottish origin, whose father was an officer in the Swedish services. Lawdon, however, served first in the Russian army, then offered his experience to Frederick II of Prussia. Yet, rebuffed by him, Lawdon joined the largely Austrian army of the Holy Roman Emperor and defeated Frederick in battle. Such switches were rare in my own time, but not unheard of. Since right into the middle of the 19th century, the vast majority of recruits had only a very scant education. Mass illiteracy prevailed for generations. They had to serve a long time in the army, frequently 3, sometimes 4 years. Those who had bachelor's degrees, age group 18 to 19 years, served only 1 year and received commissions and became reserve officers. The idea was to have trained soldiers under arms, as well as in a reserve capacity, periodically called to manoeuvres. The loss of time for all was considerable. Yet, if one major power adopted that system, it literally forced other countries on the same continent, in order not to be outnumbered, to do exactly the same. And, since the European monarchies in Europe had painfully experienced the numerical superiority of the French armies in the Napoleonic Wars, as constitutional monarchies were drifting into the democratic cauldron, they too were now victims of a phenomenon called militarism, resulting in the armed horde. England, relying on its splendid isolation, was an exception from the rule, but the United States, politically already a victim of the French school, drafted in the war between the states not only its citizens, but even the foreigners on its soil. Although these could not vote, they earned money, and thus cash was redeemed by blood. Voluntary military service is a different matter. On a lower level, it might rely on the desire to fight. On a higher one, on the fascination of army life. On the highest, on the wish to defend one's country or bring to life a great ideal. In the book from which we quoted Taine, the American author Hoffman Nickerson wrote, quote, "During the last century and a half, civilization has recreated the armed horde. Previously a rarity, it has become the accepted instrument of any great military effort. It has not, however, come alone." Exactly 150 years ago, in 1789, shortly after the United States had sought to protect themselves against democracy by their federal constitution, the French Revolution began. From that time to our day, democratic ideas have come to dominate politics, just as the mass army has dominated war. It is the thesis of this book that the two are inseparably connected with each other, and with a third thing, barbarism. End quote. 4. The 19th century compromise of monarchy with democracy was also symbolized by the fact that the monarchs appeared in military uniforms and figured prominently as heads of the army. The horizontal identitarian order assumed an increasingly national, ethnic character, and the general tendency was toward the ethnically unified state. We were faced by Pan-Germanism, Pan-Italianism, the Risorgimento movement, and even by Pan-Slavism, which transcended the minor ethnic boundaries. Hand in hand with this evolution, we see in the German-speaking and Slavic areas the rise of collective gymnastic movements, cultivating a violent nationalistic spirit and manifesting themselves in gigantic synchronized performances. This physical training also implied a paramilitary aim to impress the public with numbers. Here we have undoubtedly one of the psychological roots of National Socialism. The communists, too, loved synchronized, uniformed mass performances. Horizontalism asserted itself visually. This is part of the 19th century's still mixed transformation. Needless to say that the new ideal, the ethnically uniform state, is more in harmony with militarization than the ethnically mixed state, and also for the development of parliamentary institutions. Mark Twain has given us an account of parliamentary life in Vienna, and John Stuart Mill has insisted that democracy is problematic in a multilingual state. No wonder, since totalitarian institutions need linguistic uniformity. Added to this is the fact that the ethnic majority, through its party or parties, seeks to rule democratically, but not in a liberal way, over the minorities. Multilinguality in a parliament as well as in an army creates enormous difficulties. Hence also the hostility of the French Revolution toward the use of non-French languages in the Republic. The rise of democracy and of ethnic nationalism went in synchro mesh. These two horizontal mass movements easily combined in the name of the demos. It is significant that the armed forces of the Red German Democratic Republic were the conscripted and ideologically drilled National Volksarmee, the National People's Army, in whose name the term people appears in two forms. Yet when the monarchist nobleman Charles de Gaulle proposed to the socialist Léon Blum to transform the French army into an army de métier, a purely professional army consisting of volunteers, his plan, as a rightist undemocratic trick, was immediately rejected. Such an army could be easily mobilized against the dear people and might develop an esprit de corps which would be fully undemocratic. 5. We already spoke about the indoctrination of draftees, which, naturally, becomes very important in a time of war. An even greater evil is the fact that, since the recruits are taken from the population at large, the people itself has to be indoctrinated. In other words, made to hate the enemy collectively. For this purpose, governments invoke in modern times the support of mass media, which will inform the people about the evil of the enemy, with little to no regard to the truth. The attack will be launched in three directions, stressing the wickedness and inferiority of the hostile nation and the evil deeds committed by its armed forces, who consist of cowards, a low breed recruited from a fiendish people. In World War I, the Western Allies, being more democratic, were also more skilled in organizing collective hatreds. Taking advantage of the stupidity of the masses, everywhere, they could print almost anything, and even the silliest accounts were readily believed. For instance, that German soldiers cut off the hands of Belgian babies. A Dutchman, Louis Reimacher, produced in the service of the Allies incredibly nauseating etchings depicting atrocities committed by the German armies. One of the worst showed a naked French girl crucified and spat upon by bespectacled, unshaven German soldiers. Nothing like it was manufactured by the Central Powers. Georges Bonanno described in a memorable book the idiocies of French war propaganda in this period. According to Bonanno, the French were told that the German bodies on the battlefield emitted a worse stench than those of the French, and that the Germans were ridiculous cowards and did not even dare to interrupt the cozy life of the French poilus in their trenches. It was deceitful propaganda of the worst kind. Yet, during the French mutinies in 1917, whole battalions were decimated, i.e. every tenth man executed, so the war was not so entertaining or cozy at all. Naturally, World War I was no longer a cabinet war between monarchs, but already what the Germans called a Völkerringen, a war between nations. At least up until 1917, when the Russian monarchy fell and made America's entry politically feasible. Then it became an ideological crusade to make the world safe for democracy, as we had experienced already at the end of the 18th century, when France challenged Europe ideologically. It was interesting to see how the tensions were different on the two fronts, East and West. In the East, it was still, until 1917, a fight among three emperors, and this was the reason why the old style there somehow survived and continued on a higher level. It was still a war between gentlemen, a fact evident not only at the front, but even in the homelands. In Russia, craftsmen and tradesmen among the prisoners were often released and, until the Bolsheviks took over, they earned money very nicely. Enemy aliens were jailed in Britain, France, Italy, and Germany, but not in Austria. My family lived for half a year in an Austrian prison camp, where my father installed and ran an X-ray station, and we children loved the mostly Russian prisoners with whom we played. They taught us the Cyrillic alphabet. Then we lived nearly 2 years in Baden, near Vienna, the headquarters of the Austro-Hungarian army, where I sported a British sailor's suit with a ribbon in my cap inscribed HMS Renown. We also had a French governess, and spoke French with her in the streets. Mutatis mutandis, something of the sort would have been unthinkable in the more progressive, and therefore more debased, West. After the fall of our great fortress, Przemyśl, it was starved into surrender. The Russian officers invited their Austro-Hungarian colleagues to a banquet where they toasted each other. I know of an Austrian officer who, made a prisoner, handed to the Russians his calling card. I had fun once after a lecture in America during a debate. A professor, a real leftist jerk with long hair, dark glasses, and jeans, complained that he could not understand my term, a gentleman's war. "Of course you couldn't," was my reaction. One can imagine the hilarity of the students. 6. A war between entire nations developing into an ideological crusade, the word crusade has near-religious implications, was bound to assume total and totalitarian features. Anatole France realized this very well. The totalitarians could kindle the fervor of their soldiers more easily because they operated in a highly authoritarian framework. This also explains why the German army fought well over 2 years, 1942 to 1945, in a hopeless defensive rear action. Yet, the hate propaganda of the democracies was partly very successful. Thus, mixed with racist motives, the United States decided to put the West Coast's entire foreign as well as American population of Japanese ancestry in concentration camps, which the British had invented during the Boer War. There were among them US citizens with only one Japanese grandparent, looking like Caucasians and not speaking a word of Japanese. And, after the final mass surrender of German soldiers in May 1945, they were not treated as ordinary war prisoners protected by the Hague Convention, but as DEF, disarmed enemy forces, and were dealt with miserably. They were starved and suffered enormous losses, possibly even 1 million. Indignation about the German concentration camps, however, played only a minor role in this policy, because the facts were largely not believed. People remembered the lies spread about the Germans during World War I. Upon entering the age of the armed horde, wars inevitably took on new forms and another character. The idea was no longer to outmaneuver the enemy and just to win battles, but, since this war was a war between peoples and ideologies, to kill as many enemies as possible, whereby wars assumed an exterminatory character. The mercenaries of the past belonged to different nationalities and, once they signed up, could be employed for different reasons and operations by their employer, or even traded in to another one. He who sells himself can also be sold to somebody else. Since wars had evolved very democratically, from clashes between crowned heads to conflicts between masses of people, entire nations became collectively enemies of other nations. Therefore, wars could at long last be waged against civilians, not only against beleaguered cities, but against entire populations, men, women, and children. And since technology had progressed, it had now become possible to attack the hinterland of the enemy, villages and cities. Aviation had done the trick. The French, pioneers in aviation, made a beginning in World War I by bombing a Corpus Christi procession in Karlsruhe and killing children. But the Germans followed up and dropped bombs from their zeppelins on British cities and fired artillery missiles from a very long distance, 80 miles, on Paris. Frenchmen had to die, regardless of age and sex, and this seemed all right. Europe had fallen as low as that. Curiously enough, it was the Third Reich, although planning aggressive wars, which desired to ban aerial warfare except on well-defined battlefronts. In 1935, the Germans, wanting a pact outlawing war on civilians in the hinterland, suggested this to Great Britain, which at the time had a Labour government. However, the offer for such a pact was turned down on the ground that all efforts to humanize war would make wars more acceptable and would thus be a blow to the noble cause of pacifism. Actually, all important British authors confirmed the thesis that, in World War II, the aerial warfare à outrance was started, willed, and perfected by the democracies, not by the National Socialists. German attacks outside of the actual war zone were always retaliations. Some British authors merely shamefacedly admitted this fact. Others boasted of it. Above all, Mr. Churchill. General J.F.C. Fuller stated rightly that, quote, "It was Mr. Churchill who lit the fuse which detonated a war of devastation and terrorization unrivaled since the invasion of the Seljuks," end quote. It reached its all-time high with the destruction of Dresden, the German Florence, with a loss of 204,000 lives, and the annihilation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Although the Japanese had twice desperately asked for armistice conditions, in April 1945 through the Vatican and in July via Moscow, the answer was only the infamous and idiotic unconditional surrender formula. The American people knew nothing about this, and during that period, not only thousands of Japanese died in vain, but also innumerable American boys. The hatred generated by propaganda heated up the horizontal collective mentality to such a degree that the war in the Pacific assumed, in the words of American socialist leader Norman Thomas, the character of a militarily organized race riot. The racist aspect of the war received a very concrete expression in a memorable incident. An American soldier sent President Roosevelt a paper knife made of the thigh bone of a Japanese soldier killed in action. The president wrote him a letter of thanks and expressed his hope to get more such presents. This piece of news reached the Japanese, whereupon Ken Harada, Japanese ambassador at the Vatican, decided to protest via Roman channels. The president then changed his mind and promised to give his paper knife a dignified burial. Could one imagine one of the crowned heads of Europe engaged in a similar incident? Francis Joseph using the thigh bone of a Prussian grenadier as a paper knife? Or Queen Victoria, in such a delicate way, the key bone of a Boer sharpshooter? Only a paramount chief of the Upper Ubangi might have acted similarly. An even graver evidence of sheer guerrillism appeared in the bombing of a Gestapo center in The Hague that killed 800 Dutch, or, even worse, the carpet bombing of Le Havre just prior to its liberation, but after the evacuation by the Germans, with more than 3,500 victims. De Gaulle in London was outraged, but the British-American allies justified themselves, saying, "We really thought that the Jerrys were still in the city." Thereupon, De Gaulle really hit the ceiling, butchering 3,500 Frenchmen just to get a few Germans. He went to Le Havre for their burial, heading the cortege with the clergy. Nor was there any respect for the cultural treasures of the Old World. In World War I, the Germans were accused of having shelled Reims Cathedral with the excuse that observers were hidden in the spire, and having willfully burned down parts of Louvain-Lens because civilians had fired on their troops. But World War II was far more progressive, which means that Europe and North America had declined for the last 200 years under populist rule and had reached the cultural and ethical level of Dahomey's Glegle or Uganda's Idi Amin Dada. The raids over Germany were called Baedeker raids because, fearing for their safety, the Allied planes flew very high and emptied their freight more or less in the historic centers of cities, destroying the most beautiful buildings, whereas the industrial war production had suffered astoundingly little. So, the hearts of Frankfurt, Munich, Nuremberg, Hamburg, and Bremen were all in shambles, but not the industrial establishments surrounding them. Some Allied spokesmen explained that one wanted to hit the workers' dwellings, while others thought that annihilating German Kultur destroyed Nazi arrogance. Yet, that blood orgy contributed very little to the Allied victory. IG Farben and other big enterprises functioned to the bitter end. One of the worst and most idiotic feats was the destruction of the ancient monastery of Monte Cassino in Italy by the American army. The Allies had been informed that there were no German troops inside. Since the building remained intact, a hue and cry was raised in the United States that to spare the monastery would mean yielding to Roman Catholic interests at the cost of American lives. Our boys would have to die just to please the Pope. Finally, the military yielded in order to bolster the home front. The vox populi should not be thwarted, and a political, not a military, decision was made. The old building went down in fire and ashes. Thereupon, it became safe for the Germans to occupy the ruins, whereas to defend a huge, solidly structured building under artillery fire would have been suicidal. Now, the American soldiers faced an enemy much better entrenched and protected by the rocks of the destroyed abbey. No falling walls could bury them. The Allied losses became now much bigger, and so were those of the poor betrayed Poles who had to fight with them. But public opinion was satisfied. The war was fought democratically. Yet what did some of the American soldiers think of the frequently irreparable losses of architectural beauty? An officer stationed near Benevento, asked whether he had any misgivings, replied to an American journalist, "There's nothing what can be done about it. Italy is just lousy with clerical monuments." Most unfortunately, World War II had also another fatal aspect. The resistance movement, enthusiastically applauded by the public of the Western Alliance. An exception has to be made for the Polish Armia Krajowa, as well as for Jewish fighters, because the National, like the International Socialists, wanted to deprive them of their upper classes, or to exterminate them altogether. With no legal armies for their defense, they had the moral right to fight in order to protect their very existence. Yet, as in other countries, the occupying army had no other means to combat these sly attackers but to take hostages and shoot them. Nations, not completely democratized, did not engage in such activities, and only too often resistors were former collaborators who, sensing that the Third Reich was a sinking ship, changed sides. Obviously, the French resistance became truly active only after the collapse of the National International Alliance. There had been a predecessor to the civilian resistance, after France became a republic in 1870, in the form of the Franc-Tireur, entirely in keeping with the rising horizontalism. One used to have naturally no right to participate in a war without wearing the king's coat. The alternative was to sink down to the level of savages. This was somewhat different in the case of the Balkans, where, after 50 years of Turkish rule, the Christian tradition had been broken and one went to war collectively, as we painfully experienced in two world wars. First, we had the nationalistic Komitadjis, then the ideological Partisani. 7. One of the worst results of the democratization of wars was and remains the difficulty in terminating war by peace, or at least by lengthy periods of peace, because, in a slowly democratized or fully democratic order, having fought with conscripted soldiers, one is governed largely by representatives of the people, by men who do not think historically, but politically. Of history, economics, cultural mentalities, and geography, they know nothing. Moreover, they think personally, not dynastically. What do they have primarily in mind? The weal of their grand and great-grandchildren, or the winning of the next election? The returning soldiers, too, if they have been fighting on the winning side, want to see the fruits of their sufferings and yearn for a peace with maximum gains for their country. Mercenaries thought otherwise. They had their next job in mind. Moreover, generosity is a virtue more frequently found in the small top layers than among the masses. It takes, after all, intelligence to suspect that generosity very often pays, while egotism does not. Fenelon, in a brilliant book, exhorted the Dauphin, quote, "Peace treaties are meaningless if you are the stronger one, and if you force your neighbor to sign a treaty to avoid greater evil. Then he signs in the same way as a person who surrenders his purse to a brigand who points his pistol at his throat," end quote. Yet, already in the 19th century, in which we witnessed the democratization of constitutional monarchies, we see that the warning of Fenelon was increasingly ignored. The German drive for unification and the Italian Risorgimento offered opportunities to annex entire countries and to make dynasties homeless. In this respect, the Italians made the start. The sovereigns of Modena, Parma, Tuscany and the Bourbons of both Sicilies had to quit. After the liberation of Schleswig-Holstein from Danish rule by the German League, the legitimate heirs were not allowed to take over their inheritance. The situation was made worse by the outcome of the German-Prussian War of 1866, which ended Prussia's incorporation not only of Schleswig-Holstein, but also of Hesse-Nassau, the imperial city of Frankfurt, and, by no means last, the Kingdom of Hanover. This was the policy of Bismarck, who had started his life as a typical Prussian conservative and a devout Lutheran Christian, but who became a German nationalist and a national liberal who, soon after the establishment of the German Empire, the Second Reich, initiated as a nationalistic progressivist the Kulturkampf against the Catholic Church. Yet the real break came at the end of World War I, which, as we have said, changed from a war between nations into an ideological crusade to make the world safe for democracy. By 1900, Europe had only two democratic republics, France and Switzerland, a form of government then represented on this globe largely by South and Central American nations, enriched in 1910 and 12 by Portugal and China. The great victory of democracy in Central Europe, its triumph in Russia lasted only 7 months, and the disappearance of the three emperors created a new scene. The Democrats expected to fashion the peace democratically, i.e. by the consent of the majority of the voters in the victorious nations. Of course, if we look at the 14 points of Wilson, the defeated should have expected the principles of self-determination applied even to them, but this lovely document had merely been a bait for surrender, like the mockery of the Atlantic Charter. Since the victors were democracies, the treaties were not treaties, but dictates that had to please the voters at home. Since these had been taught to hate the enemy, the dictates were in reality voted for, even if indirectly, by the agitated masses. In Britain, we had the famous khaki election, an orgy of demagoguery in which Lloyd George promised to ruin the German middle class through exorbitant reparations, to make Germany pay so that the pips squeak, and to hang the Kaiser. George F. Kennan has said very rightly that our evils nearly all go back to World War I, not to the fighting, but to the outcome. I would name 4 reasons for his thesis. The American intervention, which artificially prolonged the war and prevented a compromise peace. The combination of national combat with an ideological crusade, thus aggravating the issue. The mountainous historical, geographic, economic, and psychological ignorance of the politicians who, naturally, thinking only of the elections, wanted to please the voters. And the intellectual vacuum of the dear people, whose emotions had been whipped up to the nth degree. The bad taste of a Bismarck, who organized the celebrations for the establishment of the Second Reich in Versailles, was now imitated by these clowns, who prepared the humiliation of the German Reich in the mirror hall of the same building. There, as in the far more important dictates of Saint-Germain-en-Laye and Trianon, were laid the foundations of the Third Reich and World War II, with an admirable foresight and loving care in all details. Needless to say, the Versailles Treaty did tremendous harm in Germany internally, but it hardly changed the map of Europe. It was the destruction of the Habsburg Empire that made Germany the geopolitical winner of World War I. Bordering after 1919 on only one great power, France, it was now the direct or indirect neighbor in the east of partly artificial, partly militarily indefensible states. As His Magnificence, the rector of Breslau University, Ernst Kurnemann, pointed out in 1926, the time to take advantage of this advantageous situation would come sooner or later. And it came. What Hitler actually inherited from these nincompoops who had dictated the Paris Suburban Treaties was not only an internal situation characterized by the economic uprooting of important social layers and the imposition of an unworkable form of government, but also a uniquely profitable geopolitical position due to the division of Austria-Hungary. If Hitler had had any sense of humour, he would have erected a colossal monument to Woodrow Wilson. Looking back at these happenings, John Maynard Keynes, who assisted Lloyd George at these conferences, could write that, quote, "The Carthaginian peace is not practically right and possible. The clock cannot be set back without setting up such strains in the European structure and letting loose such human and spiritual forces as, pushing beyond frontiers and races, will overwhelm not only you and your guarantees, but your institutions and the existing order of your society." End quote. Well, one of these guarantees was the League of Nations, which Compton Mackenzie called a typist's dream of the Holy Roman Empire, and which the Congress of the United States refused to join. Still, there is no doubt that general satisfaction reigned in the nations of the victors, not only among Americans, British, French, and Italians, but also among the Czechs, Romanians, and Serbs. However, intelligent Poles, seeing their country buffeted between Germany and the Soviet Union, remained skeptical. Yet history, always immensely brutal, might have said to the defeated, "Since you were disloyal to your better self, to your heritage and traditions, you will serve not emperors, but exterminators, in abject slavery, pitiless megalomaniacs who will force you back to another slaughter." And to the victors, she would say, "Profiting from your huge superiority in men and wealth, you have abused your triumph and have paid dearly not only with men, women, and children, but moreover lost your worldwide prestige and possessions." Looking back to World War I, the old democratic enthusiasm for extending the great ideals of the French Revolution reappears, even at the price of enormous bloodshed, because democracy means to simple spirits freedom from rule, from above or from outside. When a compromise peace was in the offering, the democratic idealists went up in arms. The left hand of Wilson in foreign politics, George D. Herron, preferred even a Prussian victory to a compromise peace, which to him meant aristocracy, the Ruhr barons, the Catholic Church, and the Habsburgs, and would, quote, "break God's heart." Whereas even after a triumph of the Hohenzollerns, the nations, quote, "still might awake after a long baleful night to cosmic intimacy and infinite knowledge," end quote. Herron was greatly admired by Wilson, who made him his go-between in Europe during the war, and thus gave him the opportunity to torpedo the Austrian peace effort in February 1918, because it would have meant the political survival of the Habsburgs. Yet, if you have conscription, the lives of soldiers are of little value. They are easily replaceable. The same holds true for the rebuff suffered by the secret German right before the outbreak of World War II, the Halder-Beck conspiracy, and then during the war of their efforts through Dr. Bell, the Bishop of Chichester, who begged in vain to get the cooperation of Winston Churchill. The Germans had to sign the treaty in Versailles because the hunger blockade worked like thumbscrews. The hope for a liberal democracy in Russia had been snuffed out by the radical social democrats, the so-called Bolsheviks, and thus Russia was no longer a fit partner in a League of Honor, as Wilson had greeted the rule of Alexander Kerensky. The new Russia, the socialist fatherland, had, 20 years later, the delightful chance to start World War II jointly with the National Socialists. Had the European monarchs ever tried to enforce monarchism either in the Second or the Third French Republic, in Brazil after the fall of the monarchy, or in Portugal in 1910? No, because there was no such thing as monarchism. Democracy, as democratism, is a Gnostic ideology, hell-bent on saving the world. Monarchy is familistic. The family is something natural. It needs no philosophical impulses. It represents no secular religion. Yet, to make the people happy after one's own fashion requires sometimes a little and occasionally even a lot of pressure. In February 1914, Mr. Wilson thought that the Mexicans would be much happier if they imitated politically the United States, which in turn had imitated France. This worried Sir Edward Grey, British Foreign Minister. A curious dialogue developed between Grey and the American ambassador, Walter Hines Page. The theme was the Mexican reluctance to adopt a full-fledged democracy, which the United States, after all, had fostered and abetted in Mexico even before the days they had supported Benito Juarez, the murderer of Emperor Maximilian. And such was the exchange of opinions. Grey: suppose you have to intervene, what then? Page: make 'em vote and live by their decisions. Grey: but suppose they will not so live. Page: we'll go in again and make 'em vote again. Grey: and keep this up for 200 years? Page: yes, the United States will be here for 200 years, and it can continue to shoot them for that little space till they learn to vote and rule themselves. With that unsophisticated mentality, the young democracies were forced to enjoy self-government, to rave about their new republican liberty. This wording reminds one of the Napoleonic conquerors of the Tyrol and the spirit in which the suburban Paris treaties were dictated. France had drowned Europe in blood during the 1795 to 1815 period, yet at the Congress of Vienna, its delegates were received in great honour. The language of the sessions and discussions was French, and France left the conference tables slightly enlarged. There was no cry to hang the emperor, nor was there a public whose animal craving for revenge had to be satisfied. 8. Of course, it would be naive to think that wars in the truly monarchical period of our Christian history were a pleasant pastime. Wars were not infrequent, and the discipline among the mercenaries was miserable. Occupied cities had to pay contributions, taking booty was accepted, marauding soldiers were a plague. It was only in the 18th century that wars had assumed a civilized character. The fact that the generals belonged to noble families helped greatly. They had the right upbringing, and Europe's aristocracy was internationally related, although not to the extent of the royal imperial families. In judging the character of their enemies, they certainly were never influenced by the mass media. One cannot imagine Marlborough being moved by the editorials in London's Daily Courant, as President Kennedy was by David Halberstam of the New York Times. The monarchs, however, were not only an international but also an interracial breed, a great advantage also to the nations they ruled, because it gave them a certain distance from their subjects, whom thus they could judge more objectively. In 1909, the only genuinely native sovereign dynasties in Europe were the Petrovic Niegos in Montenegro and the Karagiorgovic in Serbia, certainly not the most important or distinguished ones. The House of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha ruled in Saxe-Coburg, Great Britain, Belgium, Portugal, and Bulgaria. The Holstein-Gottorps in Russia, where the real Romanovs had died out with Peter II. The Bourbons in Spain. The Alemannic Hohenzollerns in Prussia and Romania. The Sonderburg-Glücksburg-Augustenburgs in Denmark, Norway, and Greece. The Nassaus in the Netherlands and in Luxembourg. The Swiss Lotharingian Habsburgs in Austria-Hungary, and the French Savoys in Italy. They all descended from Muhammad, from Charlemagne, had a drop of Jewish blood, and, looking at the motherline of Maria Theresia, one comes from Cumanian, Turk-Tatar princes. It is true that the Reformation raised a wall between the Catholic and Protestant families, but it was sometimes broken. In spite of quarrels, wars, and denominational differences, even as late as 1870, the defeated Napoleon III dined as a prisoner, together with William I of Prussia and Bismarck, in Wilhelmshohe Castle, where the Prussian king addressed the Emperor of the French as Mon cher Monsieur Frère. self-control, good manners, and generosity belonged to a monarch. Here we have to keep in mind that the interrelationship between the monarchs was tightened in the course of the centuries, but they also were not entirely immune to the influences of the historic developments after 1789. In other words, to democracy, socialism, nationalism, to horizontalist temptations. It is even doubtful whether Lloyd George alone was responsible for not saving the lives of the Russian imperial family. The British in 1917 refused to give them asylum. Monarchy had several great advantages. First of all, one could expect a monarch to be psychologically and intellectually prepared for the task. Contemplating the intellectual preparation of some leading politicians for their task, one can only throw up one's hands in horror. Often their looks and their gift of gab alone get them into office. A second asset is, or rather was, their international relationships and their lack of local ties. Number three is the fact that they owe their position to no party, faction, estate, interest group, or class, but only, to use the words of Bossuet, to the sweet process of nature. The fourth advantage is that the monarchs had the chance to act historically. It is obvious that in democracies, where the primary problem is to win the elections, and where instability with nicely spaced changes, a sort of Punch and Judy show, is even a matter of pride, a constructive foreign policy is well nigh impossible. Monarchs were in office until they died and left their realm to their sons or nearest relative. They could act historically, not politically, in a way without a time limit, hence their various political testaments. This has been aptly demonstrated by Professor Hans Hermann Hopper in an essay which likened the democratic process to a small child wanting to get his wishes fulfilled immediately and protesting in tears if there is a delay or a negative reaction. A monarch, as members of a dynasty, can plan for the distant future, even for generations. Yet it would be most erroneous to believe that a return to monarchy, even a Christian monarchy, would solve all our problems. Remember the praise the great monarchist Charles Murat bestowed on this form of government: the least evil, the possibility of something good. Still, a monarch as member of a dynasty can plan for the distant future, even for generations. In our time, with the globe transformed into an immensely complex scenery, the abyss between the Skytar and the Skyender, the actual knowledge of voters and candidates compared with the necessary knowledge is unavoidably widening all the time. And since the required knowledge among those active or passive in the democratic process is minute, only sentiments, sympathies, antipathies, pleasing and unpleasant factors are now effective. Hence, democracies act like rabbits, jumping in all imaginable directions, into unwanted wars, idealistic crusades, and into undesirable, fatal peace arrangements. From their childhood on, monarchs were prepared for their duties. They inherited their profession as traditionally as craftsmen did in the past. The son of a tailor became a tailor, and so forth. These tailors produced passable garments, sometimes bad ones, occasionally even excellent ones. So with the monarchs. Yet dentists, lawyers, cobblers, farmers, and plumbers could not have produced any clothes whatsoever, but only sheer monstrosities. Hence the decline of Europe, lasting already more than 200 years, which also means that one should not forget the already once mentioned fact that monarchy compromised with democracy during the 19th century and acquired merely a psychological role in the 20th. Wars, however, are undesirable under all circumstances. The ideal solution, at present a dream without any hope of realization, would be a gremium of Christian monarchs, such as we have in a Muslim version in Malaysia, controlling the globe. Aware of the fact that wars today, thanks to the developments of technology, chemistry, physics, and biology, have assumed a suicidal character. They menace the survival of all mankind, which, so far, has spiritually no common denominator. Neither has the UN, nor really the European Union. So far, it can only boast a common economic unity to become more prosperous, and a common defense against outside enemies, but without any aggressive drive. Under these circumstances, its coat of arms should be a fat porcupine, a beast fairly safe in its natural surroundings, but certainly not a valid symbol for Europe.